It's Friday, November 1st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Coming up, the U.S. House of Representatives votes to authorize a public impeachment inquiry targeting President Donald Trump.
On this vote, the yeas are 232, the nays are 196. The resolution is adopted without objection. The motion to reconsider is laid upon the table.
Also ahead, Islamic State announces its new leader. The UN denounces repression in Indian-ruled Kashmir. What prompted some Vietnamese to risk their lives to get to Britain? We'll look at the fall of the Berlin Wall 30 years on, and a new exhibit looks at the life of author J.D. Salinger. That's all on today's International Edition. The Democratic-controlled U.S. House of Representatives voted Thursday to authorize a public impeachment inquiry targeting President Donald Trump after weeks of testimony behind closed doors about his efforts to push Ukraine to investigate his political opponents. The vote was along party lines, 232 to 196 for the impeachment inquiry, with all Republicans voting against the resolution and two Democratic defectors joining them. Before the vote, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi called it a sad day, but said members needed to do what was good for the country and not just their own political party.
I don't know why the Republicans are afraid of the truth. Every member should support allowing the American people to hear the facts for themselves. That is really what this vote is about. What it's about, the truth. And what is at stake? What is at stake in all of this is nothing less than our democracy.
House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy said that Democrats are pursuing impeachment against President Trump because they cannot beat him at the ballot box.
Democrats are trying to impeach the president because they are scared they cannot defeat him at the ballot box. That's not my words. That's the words of my colleagues from the other side of the aisle that has offered impeachment three different times. This impeachment is not only an attempt to undo the last election, it is an attempt to influence the next one as well.
VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson joins us. Catherine, first off, let's clear this up for people where there might be a question. Thursday's vote was not the vote to impeach the president that everybody's talking about. Thursday's vote was you can start the process of formally impeaching the president, right?
Absolutely. You have absolutely nailed down that key difference that House Democrats have been talking about all week. They were telling reporters, this is not an impeachment vote. Please do not describe it as such. This really is just laying out the ground rules for the next phase of the impeachment inquiry investigation. Now, that said, this is the first time that a vote on the House floor has happened regarding impeachment. So in a way, it is the first time that members have gone on the record voting for or against an impeachment inquiry. And in that sense, today was a big deal.
And this is something that Republican members of the House have been calling for in previous weeks, is it not? I mean, they've been saying the closed door hearings before the Oversight and Intelligence and Judiciary Committees in the House. Why don't you have open hearings? Why don't you have public hearings? And wasn't today the first step of saying, okay, let's go ahead and have them?
Right. And House Republicans were also saying you need to hold a floor vote just to start this entire process, that until you hold that vote in the U.S. House of Representatives, this inquiry isn't even legitimate. And that's one of the reasons the Trump administration has been able to use for saying that they're not going to hand over documents because of these court orders. Now, of course, we're in different territory. We're in this territory where there has been a full House floor vote, where the procedures are laid out to have public hearings when the House comes back in session in mid-November. And House Republicans are still unhappy about it.
And the president is not happy about it either. He tweeted about it being the greatest witch hunt ever or something like that immediately after the vote. Now, there have been a string of witnesses that have been testifying, most of them career civil servants, people from the State Department, people from the National Security Council, stuff like that. Will those same people be called back to testify in public hearings? Will we see them in the way that we saw some of the testimony in the Mueller hearing, where they're sitting in front of a panel full of lawmakers and being asked questions in public?
Great question. I think that we're going to see many of them out in those public hearings. I would lay bets that Gordon Sondland is going to be coming up again to the Hill for public testimony. Kurt Volker, you know, some of those names that we've been hearing about who are major players in U.S.-Ukraine foreign policy. Adam Schiff and his intelligence committee, who are in charge of these hearings, are going to put them on the spot. They're going to want the American people to hear what they have to say out in the open, out in public.
Now, what's the next step? Where do we go from here? Do we go directly to public hearings, or do we go to more closed-door hearings and then the public hearing date is set? What's next for the inquiry?
So the House actually went out of session for about 10 days after the vote today. But the House Intelligence Committee is going to continue those closed-door depositions as they finish building their case. We're going to likely hear from former National Security Advisor John Bolton. We know that House Intelligence Committee Chairman Adam Schiff has invited him for testimony next week. There's a number of other career civil servants who need to come behind for the committee. That's all part of building this case out before they can go to the public phase.
And just to clear this up for our audience, it is not the House that determines whether the president is removed from office or not. The House recommends to the Senate, which is controlled by the Republican Party, and the Senate has to have a two-thirds majority of its number, or 66 members, vote to remove a president, right?
That is right. So this is a two-step process that we have going here. Right now, we're in the first step of the process with the U.S. House of Representatives. Think of impeachment as almost like drawing up the charges against the president. The House votes on those charges and then recommends it to go over to the U.S. Senate, where they hold a trial on those charges. And the U.S. Senate is the one who decides if the president is acquitted or if he is actually removed from office, which, as we know, has never actually happened in American history.
Well, Catherine, thank you so much for giving us this primer on what's going on. You can follow Catherine's coverage on our website. That's voanews.com. Among the top stories in the world, ex-Trump advisor Morrison testifies on concerns about Ukraine. Floods leave hundreds of thousands of Somalis needing aid. Minister says Turkey-Russia negotiating return of 18 captured Syrian soldiers. Violations, violence, and repression remain rampant in Indian-administered Kashmir. And Iraqi protesters reject leadership changes and demand systemic overhaul. Expanded coverage of these stories and more is on the voanews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Thanks for being with us on this Friday. I'm David Byrd in Washington. The Islamic State group declared a new leader Thursday after it confirmed the death of its former leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, in a U.S. raid in Syria. In its audio release by the IS Central Media Arm, a new spokesman for Islamic State identifies the successor as Abu Ibrahim al-Hashimi al-Qureshi, tracing his lineage, like al-Baghdadi, to the Prophet Muhammad's Quraysh tribe. The announcement said the Shura Council met immediately after confirming al-Baghdadi's death and had pledged allegiance to al-Qureshi as the new leader of the believers. It provided no other details about al-Qureshi, and it was not immediately clear who the name was referring to. The group typically identifies its leaders using noms de guerre that refer to their tribal affiliation and lineage. Those names often change. The announcement specifically talked to the United States, saying it should not rejoice over the death of Baghdadi, and warned that the terrorist group stands at the threshold of Europe and Central Africa and claimed its influence was expanding. The speaker in the audio also confirmed the death of Abu Hassan al-Muhajir, a close aide of al-Baghdadi and a spokesman for the group since 2016. Al-Muhajir was killed in a joint U.S. operation with Kurdish forces in Yarbulus in northern Syria on Sunday, just hours after Baghdadi blew himself up during a U.S. raid in Syria's northwestern Idlib province. The killings were a double blow to the extremist group nearly 7 months after its territorial defeat in Syria. The UN Human Rights Office has denounced what it calls the ongoing repression in Indian-administered Kashmir and is urging the government to restore the rights stripped from the region's millions of Muslim inhabitants in August. Lisa Schlein reports from the agency's headquarters in Geneva.
India's only Muslim-majority state of Jammu and Kashmir has officially ceased to exist. On August 5th, the Indian government revoked constitutional provisions that granted partial autonomy to the area. As a result, the region was divided into two separate federally administered states. The territory of Jammu and Kashmir includes the restive Muslim-majority Kashmir Valley and the Hindu-majority Jammu. The second territory includes the high-altitude Buddhist enclave of Ladakh. This move, which came into effect on Thursday, ends 7 decades of self-rule for the region. The Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights says it deplores the restrictive measures and what it calls the wide range of rights abuses that have continued unabated since August. In large parts of the Kashmir Valley, it reports an undeclared curfew is preventing the free movement of people and restricting their rights to health, education, and freedom of religion and belief. Human rights spokesman Rupert Colville says the agency has heard about allegations of excessive use of force by security forces during sporadic protests. He says at least 6 people reportedly have been killed and scores seriously injured in separate incidents since the area was split into two.
We've also received reports of armed groups operating in Indian-administered Kashmir, threatening residents trying to carry out their normal business or attend school, as well as several allegations of violence against people who have not complied with the armed group's demands. Hundreds of political and civil society leaders, including 3 former chief ministers of Jammu and Kashmir, have been detained on a preventative basis.
Colville says his office also has received allegations of torture and ill treatment of people held in detention. He notes torture is banned under international law and says these allegations must be independently and impartially investigated. Colville says restrictions on landline telephones have been lifted, but all internet services remain blocked in the Kashmir Valley. At the same time, he says media outlets face restrictions and several journalists allegedly have been arrested in the past 3 months. He says the people of Kashmir remain bound to the whims and wills of the government. He says major political decisions about the future status of Jammu and Kashmir are taken without their consent. He notes the region's leaders are being detained and their right to freedom of expression and political participation undermined. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi has defended the split, saying the special status had impeded the region's progress, given rise to terrorism, and was used as a weapon by rival Pakistan to instigate some people. India has long accused Pakistan of supporting and training militants to foment a separatist insurgency in Kashmir. Charges Islamabad denies. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Hong Kong police fired tear gas on Thursday against masked pro-democracy protesters and Halloween revelers in the territory's nightlife district. Riot police began firing tear gas shells after the demonstrators urged others to celebrate Halloween by wearing masks, including those depicting Carrie Lam, the city's embattled chief executive, China's President Xi Jinping, and other government officials. Police also fired tear gas to disperse hundreds of protesters, many wearing masks, on one of the major thoroughfares in Kowloon, an area in northern Hong Kong on the other side of Victoria Harbor. Thousands of masked demonstrators have marched through Hong Kong streets since June, sparked by anger over a controversial extradition bill that evolved into demands for full democracy for the Chinese-controlled city. British and Belgian police are continuing their investigations into the people smuggling networks that transported 39 migrants who were found dead in the back of a refrigerated truck near London last week. Suffocation is the suspected cause of the migrants' death in the sealed container. Many of the victims are believed to be of Vietnamese origin and appear to have traveled across the border to China, then to Russia and Europe, before crossing the English Channel to Purfleet on the River Thames. The truck was reportedly registered in Bulgaria. The 25-year-old driver, Maurice Robinson, from Northern Ireland, has been charged with manslaughter, people trafficking, and money laundering. The migrants' journey reportedly began 9,000 kilometers away in the remote Nha An and Hanoi provinces in northern Vietnam. As Henry Ridgewell reports from London, many Vietnamese are lured overseas by the potential profits of working in illegal industries.
Unseen and unheard, hidden in Britain's shadow economy, many migrants who enter Britain illegally are keen to profit from industries that are unlawful and unregulated. Tamsin Barber, an expert on Vietnamese diaspora in Britain, says many are willing to take huge risks.
And they're doing that because they know that when they get to the UK, the likelihood is they're going to be able to find work in the cannabis industry, where they might be able to earn large amounts of money in a short period of time, paying back their debts, the debts to the smugglers, and then eventually being able to pay, send remittances back to their family.
As well as the illegal cannabis industry, many Vietnamese work in nail salons, which have boomed on British streets in recent years. Others work in the restaurant trade as cleaners, some in prostitution. Once here, many migrants are trapped.
When they get to the UK, the debt bondage, that huge debt, $30,000 to $40,000, is taken from their wages. If they don't behave or if they don't follow instructions, there could be also ramifications for their family back in Vietnam from those people smuggling gangs.
Some migrants endure slave-like conditions.
They're scared to death that if they are reported or somehow seek out the authorities because they're being abused so badly, that all that will happen is they'll be arrested and sent back to Vietnam, still owing a large debt.
Despite the risks, sending a family member overseas is often a joint decision.
The methods that families might use to try and raise this sort of money, which might be selling land, it might be remortgaging their houses, it might be borrowing money from moneylenders at very high sort of interest rates.
If successful, the profits can transform communities back home. In Do Thanh, south of Hanoi, rundown shacks are being replaced with luxury villas.
Originally, the entirety of Do Thanh commune was just farmers working in the fields. But then some people went overseas to work where they got rich. That's why many people rush to go, both flying there legally and using illegal underground routes.
That illegal route ended in tragedy for 39 migrants crossing to Britain.
They're taking these dangerous routes, and it's likely they're still going to continue to come because there's so much to be gained from their migration here in the UK.
The potential profits versus the terrifying risks. Such is the dilemma facing migrants seeking a better life in Britain. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Coming up, it's been 30 years since the Berlin Wall came down, and a special exhibit on J.D. Salinger opens in New York. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's Newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong.
You love music?
How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Coming up, there's a new exhibit about author J.D. Salinger. But first, it was 30 years ago this month that the Berlin Wall fell, ending the divide between the communist East and the democratic West. The wall's demise brought an end to a divided Berlin and symbolized the eventual liberation of East Germany and later the rest of Eastern Europe from Soviet communist rule. But as Charles Maines reports, while the wall is long gone, it still casts a shadow over German life.
The moment remains one of the most searing and hopeful events of the 20th century. On television, the images inspired the world. In Berlin, the night changed lives.
Many people coming from the east to the west, and we were going into the opposite direction. And there was this white line.
Florian Schmidt was then a student in West Berlin. He was one of thousands of Germans that charged the wall that night, ushering in a new Europe, almost by accident.
For me, in this moment, it was also a bit adrenaline and like danger. And in the days after, you really only realized how historic this moment was. Nothing was the same.
30 years on, you can just wander back and forth. Scattered remains of the wall also snake through the city, prompting the constant question from visitors, is this East or is this West? Yet the story still inspires, as does a memorial marking Germany's peaceful revolution and the lives senselessly lost before it arrived.
I think it's a very peaceful, lovely place to be when you come in here, but this is always the reminder of what did happen. Let's hope it never happens again.
The darker side of life in communist East Germany, the so-called German Democratic Republic, or GDR, has not been forgotten. Berlin's Stasi Museum documents the abuses of the once feared East German secret police.
You had always the feeling when you were here that they were watching you. So it's a very repressive regime.
Yet with time, call it nostalgia, call it curiosity, there's also growing interest in what it was like to actually live there. At Berlin's GDR Museum, visitors can test drive East Germany's ubiquitous clunker, the Trabant, experience life in a communist flat, or just laugh at the weirder aspects of living in the GDR.
Besides all these serious and negative side of this socialist dictatorship, there was a normal life. And people got used to living in such a state, and they had good lives, and not weren't faced with repressions every day. This was the minority, and very important minority, but you also have to tell the story of the majority.
In these dueling interpretations, say observers, lies a deeper truth. 30 years after the fall of the wall, Berlin is unified, but East and West Germany are still strangers.
So there is that element. I think there is still an element of humiliation whereby a lot of East Germans vis-a-vis West Germany or Central Europeans vis-a-vis Western Europe point to the fact that despite the enormous effort that they have made, they're still somehow being treated as second-class Europeans or second-class Germans, that they're still not quite there.
Recent polls found more than half of Germans, 53%, believe their democracy is in danger, result of rising nationalism in the country's east. Yet East Germans' faith in their government is also shaken, reflection of lagging economic prosperity. It all ties back to that moment in 89. After the party, the cleanup has been long and hard. Yet those who were there admit that while mistakes were made, Germans still made the right choice, ultimately the only choice.
When you really think of how it was used to be here, it's just a step that had to happen and that was 100% right. Some things had been done wrong, but in the end, it was right.
30 years on, the fall of the wall is still a moment to celebrate, but with room for reflection for those still caught in its shadow. Charles Maines for VOA News, Berlin.
The New York Public Library just opened an exhibition dedicated to J.D. Salinger, the author of the classic coming-of-age novel Catcher in the Rye. For the first time ever, the reclusive writer's fans will be able to see his rare letters, manuscripts, photos, and other personal items. Salinger was a very private man, and a glimpse into his creative process is attracting thousands. Anna Nelson visited the exhibit, and Anna Rice has her story.
Please do not touch. This phrase perfectly describes J.D. Salinger's life. The writer of the classic Catcher in the Rye was historically reclusive, especially after he left New York for New Hampshire in 1953 and almost completely disappeared from public life.
The decision to do an exhibition at the New York Public Library was made on the part of Matt Salinger and Colleen, J.D. Salinger's widow, who are the the people who are, represent the Salinger Trust and the custodians of the archive. And all the material in this exhibition is drawn from the Salinger archive and has never been seen before.
Images of the writer as a baby in a stroller, a young Salinger wearing Second World War military uniform, and another of him holding his grandchildren. There's a copper cup he made and a dog tag he wore through the war years. His watch wasn't expensive, but he bought an expensive motion picture projector because he loved cinema. Passports and handwritten culinary recipes, life represented by a few things that tell a fascinating story.
After he gave up smoking, he still would take down a pipe and would lift an ember from his wood-burning stove and put it in there and just sort of sit and hold it because he liked the feel of the warmth in the wood.
The exhibition shows his organized notes written on tiny cards bound together. Pencils for making notes had to be yellow, the typewriter in great condition.
He never adopted any kind of technology as part of his writing. I don't believe he had a cell phone. He had a landline, of course. Typewriters are what he relied on for his communication with the outside world.
In the era of smartphones and emojis, he sent telegrams. So far, not a single biography book has been published about J.D. Salinger. In 2013, a documentary about the writer was made that included a unique short video clip made with hidden camera. In this picture, J.D. Salinger's son Matt is a small boy. Today, he's in his 50s. He's been reluctant to share much, but his stories paint a fuller picture of Salinger.
I was talking to Matt, and he was telling me that as a young boy, he would hear his father typing away in the next room, and occasionally he would hear these huge eruptions, these roars of laughter. And clearly his father was writing something that amused himself. And in a way, that sort of sums up his writing career after 1965. Salinger was very, very much determinedly just writing for himself.
People always clap for the wrong reasons, wrote Salinger in The Catcher in the Rye. Maybe that's why he chose not to see the world's response to his latest works, to be able to clap and laugh where he knew was appropriate. For Anna Nelson in New York, Anna Rice, VOA News.
Later today, Lonnie Bunch III, the founding director of the National Museum of African American History and Culture, will be sworn in as the 14th secretary of the Smithsonian Institution. Bunch attended Washington, D.C.'s Howard University and American University, where he earned degrees in American and African history. He will be the first African American to lead the Smithsonian and is the first historian to be elected secretary. He is also the first museum director to ascend to the secretary's job in 74 years. Before serving as the founding director of the African American Museum, Bunch worked in a variety of positions at the National Museum of American History, and he was also president of the Chicago Historical Society. He is also a prolific author and lecturer. And the Washington Nationals came home to the nation's capital on Thursday afternoon to the cheers of some at Dulles Airport. A massive parade is planned for the Nationals' World Series victory celebration on Constitution Avenue and Pennsylvania Avenue on Saturday. You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Mark Ferguson. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Enjoy your day.
This is VOA News.